Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to.
Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
You are about to hear a very powerful, in-depth interview with Mary Dispenza, a former Roman Catholic nun who will share her gripping story. At the age of 7, she was raped by her parish priest. And she didn't deal with it until she was almost 52 years old. Today, she shares her experience and her thoughts about the cover-up that continues in the Roman Catholic Church. I want to thank the people who subscribe and support my podcast activities here, including Paul L. Sesser, one of our long-term committed subscribers, along with Linda Clark, Andy Bettmanis, and Teresa Paris. Thank you, one and all. I invite you to join their ranks. Go to peterbcollins.com and follow the sign-up link right under my picture on the homepage. You can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers in the continental U.S., get a bonus CD, a copy of John Dist's Red Flag, great rock and roll with political themes, I highly recommend it, and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee, supplied by Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. The other way you can support our efforts, whether you subscribe or not, is to follow the link to audible.com from the homepage at peterbcollins.com. When you sign up for a free 30-day trial, Audible will reward you with a free audiobook download from their catalog of 150,000 titles. You can cancel before 30 days and you won't owe Audible a penny. But in any case, they'll reward me with a $15 bounty for referring you to their trial subscription. Thanks for your support. Today we're going to talk about the crisis in the Roman Catholic Church, where pedophile priests and bishops who've covered up for their crimes have yet to really make resolution with their victims.
God had a name, what would it be, and would you call it to his face if you were faced with him in all his glory? What would you ask if you had just one question? And yeah, God is great. Yeah, God is good. Yeah. What if God was one of us? Just a slob like one of us.
Joan Osborne asked the question, what if God was one of us? Joining me today is Mary Dispenza. She spent 15 years as a Roman Catholic nun, and she now speaks out on behalf of those who were abused by Catholic priests. Mary Dispenza, thank you for sharing your testimony, and thanks for joining me today.
You're welcome.
Mary, you have told your personal story, and I read about it in a commentary that was published on the CNN website a couple of weeks ago. And to the extent that you're comfortable talking about it, I'd like you to share with our listeners what happened to you.
Certainly. I was age 7, and in the Catholic Church, that ought to be a very special year because it's the year most of us made our first Holy Communion.
Right.
And my mom drove the school bus and worked in the office, and I went to the parish Catholic school, which was is a school in East Los Angeles. And it was just a regular school day, and things seemed quite normal. And my mom was in the lunchroom visiting the lunchroom ladies, as she often did. And I was with her, and I heard a movie going in the school auditorium, which was attached. Mm-hmm. And I wandered in, and I don't remember what movie was showing. It's like a blank in that regard. And the priest, the parish priest that I knew, was sitting halfway up and turned and called me to come to him. And I had no reason not to, because he was very kind to me. I mean, I just remember walking with him at lunchtimes and things like that. And then I would see him when I would go to the rectory to see my mom. Mm-hmm. So I had no fear, of course, and a movie's always a fun thing. So I went and crawled up on his lap, and that's when everything changed, actually. And he raped me. Mm. And my memory, of course, everything went blank. I say the screen went blank. The movie projector that was so intriguing to me stopped. Life stopped in that moment for me, and I say split. And it seems to me, my recollection seems to me that may have been 15 minutes. Sometimes I add a lifetime. And then the priest walked me to the back of this parish hall, and he left me. And I went into the small bathroom, and I washed and I washed and I washed. And then I came out, and I went back to my mom and the ladies that were still talking, and I never said a word. I never told anyone that secret. Mm-hmm. I believe it was the shame that kept me separate, that caused me to split, leave little Mary in the bathroom, and my life went on. And it wasn't until I was age 52 that I finally was able to realize that I had been raped by my parish priest.
And this was George Rucker, a Roman Catholic priest. And Mary, did he threaten you? Did he say, this is our secret, and if you tell, something bad will happen? Or was it just a kind of implicit that this was something that was wrong that neither one of you would ever talk about again?
To me, it was more that it was implicit. It was just filled with shame and sexuality. I mean, I didn't know these words at seven, but now it's like sexuality in the Catholic Church is so unaddressed, and there's so much shame about it that the secrecy is horrendous.
Mm-hmm.
So
Mary, and thank you. I you know, it's even difficult for me to ask you to retell that story, but it is so important for people to understand, because you don't come at this as a bystander or someone who heard about this from another victim. You personally experienced this and lived with it for years.
Yeah.
And I think it's very important for people to understand that many of the victims had these kind of implicit messages like you did. And, mm-hmm. and let me just share this with you. My mom is 90 years old. She's a lifelong Catholic. She raised us in the church. She has five sons, and none of us are, well, one is a practicing Catholic. And I had this discussion with her when I saw her recently, and I said, you know, It's really unbelievable the way the church has covered up the mm-hmm. sex crimes of priests. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. she said, oh, Peter, you know, many of those are exaggerated, and some of them are flatly untrue. And I was shocked because you're not the first member of the victim group of the Catholic Church and the groups that have sprung up to represent those who were affected by this. And mm-hmm. and I tried to reason with her, Mom, you know, there's no reason for someone to make this up. And,
right.
You know, while the church has paid out more than $2 billion in settlements to people who were victims of this crime wave, and we're not sure that it's actually over. We hope so, but we can't be sure. And so I offer my mother as an example of good Catholics who simply cannot believe the accusations that have been put forward by people like you, Mary.
I know. I have so much to say about this, and I really think that this secrecy thing is paramount. And in my case, Father George Neville Rucker, when I was raped and abused, it was in 1947 through 1949, and he was not defrocked till 2002. And mostly because I believe he became a liability to Cardinal Mahoney.
Yeah.
He wasn't defrocked by in 2002 to protect children. And this is just one example of many priests who have molested many children and have been shielded and protected to keep the good name, I believe, of the Catholic Church. And many older Catholics don't want to believe that these horrendous acts have happened because they love their church, and it gets all confused with this piece. And I was thinking the other day when I came back from a meeting with SNAP, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to come home, and as I met with my friends, I wanted to tell them everything that happened and share some of the stories. But by the very nature of horrendous abuse stories, you don't share. Who wants to hear about them? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It takes us down when we share. So there's these built-in protections that keep us from talking candidly and honestly about sexual abuse and violent crimes. So it's a tough one to break through
mm-hmm.
and to get us even comfortable with the topic so that we can talk about it, share about it,
mm-hmm.
listen to it, and begin to see a new reality.
And Mary, you said this provoked other reactions. Go ahead. We have plenty of time here, and I want our listeners to hear you out.
You mean reactions like in telling the stories?
Sure. Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, like a story that's just whirling around in me is I had the opportunity to walk with one of my friends. We were going to stand out in front of Our Lady of Guadalupe Cathedral in Texas, Dallas, where we had our meeting, because it became known that an ex-priest who lived in a condo in Dallas was reported by the families there as having been inappropriate with their boys in the swimming pool, and they took their story to the paper, and an article came out, and the ex-priest disappeared. So SNAP always likes to connect, if we can, with our training, any action we might take. So we went and stood outside and gave out an information about the ex-priest, because very possibly he's still in the neighborhood, and the churches should alert their parishioners. But I walked with a young man, well, not really so young, 52 years old, from SNAP, who was just dealing with his childhood priest abuse just now at age 52, and that was the year when I first was able to deal with mine. But I said to him, how old were you? And this is just one story. You can multiply this by a zillion. He said he was six. Hmm. I said, oh, you know, I said, I'm so sorry that that happened to you. And then I said, was this in the rectory? And he said, no, yes, in the rectory, in church, under the altar. And he said, and one time there were three priests messing with him, and the priests joked about confession, and one said to the other priest, Father, can you forgive me? And the other priest says, I forgive you.
Wow.
And so that story has just stayed with me, and I've been in with my friends on a couple of occasions, and I want to tell it, and it's like, oh, if I tell this story, we're having a good time right now. Like they say, well, how was your time in Dallas? And it's like, so I'm just saying that even I have trouble shedding light on these horrendous crimes against children on the part of priests. So they remain, what I'm trying to get at is they often remain hidden because of shame. And I am going to judge the church. I say the Catholic Church has been responsible in shrouding, keeping sexuality so hidden, and by not treating it as a human, beautiful quality that brings children into the world, that brings pleasure into our lives, that isn't just about sex, it's about who we are as people and human beings, and it just gets all muddied up sometimes.
And Mary, react to this if you will. I've looked at the Roman Catholic Church. As I referenced, I was raised a Catholic. I went to a Jesuit high school, and I checked out at the end of high school because I refused to accept the load of guilt and shame that they were trying to program into us around sexuality. And this was in the late 60s, early 70s, so the cultural norms were shifting, and it despite the Second Vatican Council and the efforts to modernize the church, I felt that the church was extremely out of touch at that point. And what I've seen in the interim is that the world's oldest fraternity has closed ranks to cover up crimes by its members, to protect that fraternity's image and reputation, so it can continue to mislead many people who are sincere adherents to the faith. And so the cynicism, the manipulation, the criminal behavior, the scene that you just described with the three priests kind of taunting their victim by granting absolution to each other as they violated a clear commandment and a clear teaching of the church is breathtaking as an example of the arrogance of those who become members of this fraternity. And I use the term fraternity advisedly because they set the rules that exclude women from the hierarchy. They set the rules that establish women as second-class citizens at best. They're the ones who are so oblivious to their own lack of credibility on sexuality matters that they continue to press members not to use contraception. While I support secular abortion rights, Mary, I do understand the church's teaching about abortion, and it's consistent with its position on capital punishment. And so there is some coherence on those issues. But on contraception in particular, and the way they have tried to inject the church into secular political matters since Obamacare was passed, is deeply offensive to me. And I just think that they are even further out of touch than they were when I checked out in the 1970s.
There certainly hasn't been any progress, that's for sure. And Pope Francis has mentioned that he's really values women and wants them to take a greater role in the church and things of that sort. Well, women have done more than their share in the history of the church by being the ones there to do the work and show up and all the rest. But give them some real rights. Let them be ordained. Why not? And the sexuality piece. Perhaps if priests could marry, some of our issues would be dealt with much better than they are. And you're right about priests counseling married couples. How do they have no experience.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the things are absolutely absurd. I'm not down on all priests. I've known some very good and wonderful priests. And I do believe priests can help us live our spiritual lives and show us ways to do that. However, they're not the strong voice on marriage and family and issues of sexuality, just by virtue of that, has not been their work or role or call in the world. It's to serve and help us lead spiritual lives.
Now, Mary, I want to talk to you about Pope Benedict, because he's retired and lives in an apartment there in Vatican City. He is maintaining almost complete silence. And I was surprised to learn in January that while he was pope, 400 priests were defrocked worldwide. And that is the most positive thing I can say about Benedict or Cardinal Ratzinger regarding these issues. Because for years, when he was essentially the enforcer at the Vatican, he covered up case after case. And there's documented evidence of archbishops and bishops sending him files on priests who had been violating children and begging to be given permission to usher them out of the priesthood and, in some cases, even to file criminal charges against them. And in virtually every case, Cardinal Ratzinger said, no, you cannot remove this priest, and he either said send him for treatment, further investigation, or in some cases he just said this will require more prayer. Well, in all of those steps that delayed action in removing these sexual criminals from the priesthood, it enabled them to commit other crimes. And you point out that in your own case, Father Rucker, you have learned from the recently disclosed files of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles that, that he went on to abuse many other children and wasn't, as you told us, he was not ejected from the priesthood until 2002, and at least 33 women join you as victims.
Yeah, that's 5 decades. So, and you're right about Cardinal Ratzinger. I mean, based on my reading and understanding too, and I think the 400. I mean, that might sound great, but it's just a teeny portion. And I'm sure they were the most egregious cases, and priests that had to be defrocked. There was no way of getting out of it. But the real work of, and I believe Pope Francis could do it today, to simply say to the bishops across the globe, you must release the name of any credibly accused priests to the civil authorities, and any with allegations need to be turned over for the civil authorities to do their work. I mean, that could be done tomorrow. The Pope has that kind of power. Mm-hmm. And for that not to be done, that doesn't give me much hope. It's still protecting the system, and I think when we talk about priest abuse, it's a systemic illness. It's throughout the system where priests protect priests and cover up for each other. So
yeah, and it is quite remarkable because we see that there are other enablers who maintain high-ranking positions in the Catholic Church, Bernard Law, the discredited former cardinal in Boston, who stepped down to avoid further embarrassment and possible prosecution for the sex crimes that occurred under his watch. He was promoted to Rome and given a cushy job with his own, I don't know if it's a parish or, but he's apparently got his own chapel there. And so it's like he was promoted to prince or duke. and it seems to be the way things work. And I want to go deep here on Timothy Dolan. He is now the cardinal in New York City. He is the one who is running the political operation of the Catholic bishops. And I say that advisedly because last January in 2013, when the so-called Obamacare bill was kind of rolled out and it includes contraception coverage with no copay for women who are covered under the policies. And all of a sudden, the Roman Catholic Church developed this deep moral opposition to paying for contraception, because obviously there's nothing in the law that requires anyone, Catholic or otherwise, to use contraception. The issue is narrowed to, well, we don't want to pay for it because we find it morally objectionable. Well, 95% of women of childbearing age ignore the teaching of the Roman Catholic Church on contraception. And so the bishops turn to the government in this convoluted attack on expanding healthcare access to poor people and make an issue of contraception. It is so, so insulting.
It's convoluted.
Yes, it is.
In the church and state, it's going off the topic a bit, I guess, but the church can't have everything. They can't have support and funding for their programs when they won't allow, with the insurance coverage, they won't allow money to be used for abortions or other such things. I mean, you can't have it both. You can't have financial support from the government, but then have your own rules and regulations that do not serve especially women well in many cases, or deny certain people to work in your system, be they gay or whatever, mm-hmm. while you're getting money from the government.
And Mary, how do we deal with the inverted moral priorities here? Because I would think that the Catholic bishops believe that abortion is a much greater evil than contraception. Contraception helps reduce whatever demand there is for abortion. And so it would seem to me that in the big scheme of things, to, just look the other way when it comes to contraception is an intelligent response as a way to reduce the potential for abortion.
Mm-hmm. Or the rights of women, of course. I mean, the bottom line is women should have the right to determine how they will live their lives and care for their bodies. It's not any of our right to take away that from them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the church steps in and tries, especially as part of the patriarchy, there always has been a dominance over women in different ways, and it shows up here. And I believe there was just a case about just a week or so ago, you might know more than I, about a young girl that was raped, and the church, something about not allowing her to have an abortion. Did you read about that?
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that, Mary. No.
Okay.
Yeah. But returning to Cardinal Dolan, he was the archbishop in Milwaukee. And if you have seen the HBO documentary, it's about a year old now, called Mea Maxima Culpa.
Yes, I have.
It portrays the grisly story of a priest named Lawrence Murphy. And he was the priest in charge of the St. John's School for the Deaf in St. Francis, Wisconsin. He was there for more than 20 years, and the film alleges that more than 200 boys were his victims over the years, and he preyed on them in particular because of their deafness and their inability to tell their parents what had happened to them. And Archbishop Dolan met with victims. He made noises about settlements, cash settlements, to deal with the crimes that had been committed. And then he took the archdiocese into bankruptcy, shuffling something like $70 million from the chancery's accounts into like a cemetery fund or something like that, where he could then say that the archdiocese was broke, go into bankruptcy, and either reduce or eliminate the claims that had already been approved. And this kind of duplicity on the part of a Roman Catholic archbishop now promoted to cardinal suggests to me that you get points for expanding the cover-up. You get you are recognized as a team player when you continue the cover-up and commit additional crimes in order to offset the crimes that occurred in the past. I mean, I find it mind-boggling.
Yeah, it is. And that story you're just talking about, mea culpa, is just another one that just leaves you breathless. And to take advantage of persons with disabilities is just another, I would be so ashamed to know that was happening in an organization that I was a part of, like the priesthood. I would rise up, and that's what I would have hoped the Pope would have done at that time. And Archbishop Dolan, it's tragic. It's just simply tragic.
And as I mentioned, he's now running this political operation when he announced the opposition to the contraceptive coverage in the Affordable Care Act. They used a professional PR firm. They rolled out a video. And they have these AstroTurf organizations that I'll get to in a moment who come to the defense of the church when it believes it's under attack. So, most recently, the United Nations, the United Nations Commission on the Rights of the Child conducted a series of hearings in Vatican City. And the hearings were interesting in and of themselves because often the church takes the position that the correct place to deal with the crimes of priests is only the Vatican, that they essentially declare immunity from secular law and secular judicial proceedings. Yet, when the UN came to the Vatican to confront it over its policies, to confront it over the clear pattern of crimes that have been going on for 40, maybe 50 years, perhaps longer, the church then takes a kind of Pentagon-style defense and says, well, you know, we really don't have jurisdiction in Milwaukee or in Cork Island, Ireland, or in Los Angeles, California. And so the lack of honesty and straightforward dealing on the clear pattern of crimes that has been exposed is really stunning. And it seems to be a new wave of both sin and crime on the part of the hierarchy of the church.
The way you say it, it just goes on. It gets worse and worse, and it's true. I was a Catholic until age 52, and I at one time directed the Pastoral Life Services Department for the Catholic Archdiocese of Seattle. So I don't know everything about church, but I know a whole lot about the Catholic Church, and it is so absurd for the Vatican to claim no responsibility for what goes on at archdiocesan levels, because they are so connected to what the bishops do and don't do, and what happens and what does not happen, and if something happens that they don't like, you can be sure you will hear of it. For I could go back to Seattle a long time ago when Archbishop Hunthausen showed support and love for the gay community. That was a strong piece for removing him from his position. So for the Vatican to say now, in relationship to the many, many priests, hundreds of priests abusing and committing crimes of violence against children and vulnerable young adults, that they have nothing to do with that, that's out of their jurisdiction, that's a lie. And it ought not be. And it just makes me sad also. It makes me very sad.
Yeah, I understand. And Mary, the UN Commission issued its report. It was blistering in its condemnation of the Vatican's behavior. And it gets even more controversial because they went on to criticize some of the teachings of the Catholic Church that the Commission speculates may have a direct role in both the sex crimes and the cover-ups. And it relates to the treatment of women, of gays, the issues related to sexuality. And I personally was not offended by the scope of that criticism that the UN committee leveled at the Catholic Church. But this has become a target for reverse attacks, attempting to divert attention from the true crimes of the Church and its failure to properly address them by saying that the UN is trying to use blue-helmeted officials to rewrite the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church. And so now this becomes an attack on religious freedom, which is a monstrous rewrite of the actual findings of the High Commissioner for Human Rights.
Mm-hmm. And I read that the United Nations and protecting the rights of children, they have the right to connect whenever they can issues that they deem relate to the one at hand. So that's one thing. And then secondly, for myself, I didn't take any offense. I saw a connection running through most of them of sexuality and the positions of the Catholic Church. And it made perfect sense for me that those would be linked and questioned about. And the gay thing, I mean, the Catholic Church has used that for such, the gay issue, for such a scapegoat in many instances around priest abuse. There was a time when they said it was gay, they were the gay priests, and we won't have gays anymore. And it's all to get away from the truth, which is it's not a gay thing. It's a systemic illness within the Catholic Church, and I think it does connect to its rules and the way it functions regarding priests can't marry, women's role in the church is submissive, and priests entering the priesthood also at age 13, which was the case, you know, a while back, and not having had time to grow up sexually. So there's all kinds of things the priesthood could take a look at
Now, Mary, I completely agree with you. I don't think that the UN Commission was out of bounds in the commentary that it offered, but you and I are now on the wrong side of Catholic Advocate. Let me read you their email. Dear friend, should the Vatican bow to the heavy hand of the United Nations? Well, if its latest report is any indication, the UN's blue helmets and gang of third world dictators think so. In its own words, the UN now, quote, recommends that the Holy See undertake a comprehensive review of its normative framework, in particular canon law, with a view of ensuring its full compliance with the convention. That's the International Human Rights Convention, which doesn't get fully mentioned here. This letter goes on. Bottom line, the UN is making crystal clear what we've all along suspected. It wants the Vatican to fully submit to UN authority. And then, you know what it does, Mary? It turns into a fundraising letter. It asked me to sign a petition and chip in $25. And it's signed by Matt Smith. And if you go to the website, CatholicAdvocate.com, he shows up as the only person there. And There is no staff. There is no indication that there are any other people involved. So this is what we call an AstroTurf advocacy group. And you look up who Matt Smith is. Well, he worked in the Bush White House in the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. He also was one of the White House team members who briefed the nominees to the Supreme Court, which in Bush's era included the two Catholics, Alito and Judge Roberts. And they were coached by, and I wasn't there, so I can't implicate Matt Smith directly, but they were coached by people like him on how to avoid answering questions about their position on abortion rights and whether their religious views would in any way interfere with their judicial duties. So here is Matt Smith, a guy who presumably was part of certain types of manipulation when he worked in the Bush White House, and now he is the front man for Catholic Advocate, which shows no indication of how it is funded except by asking for money from people like me. And it shows, for example, no authorization from a Catholic bishop. It appears to be independent and freestanding. But my suspicions are that it is anything but that. And then we have an article that was published at the Wall Street Journal by Claudia Rosette, who is described as journalist in residence with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, who goes after the UN report in the same fashion. So these are apologists for not just the Vatican, but for the darkest, seamiest aspect of behavior that comes from the headquarters of the Roman Catholic Church. Do you have a comment on this?
No, I don't. I'm dismayed. I go back to Pope Francis. I think this is a time in the Church that he has an opportunity to write a new chapter. And the sooner, the better. This will go on and on, and these kinds of positions you're sharing right now will go on and on. And it's not making the world a safer place for children, this kind of conversation that these persons are letter writing and sending out. And short of Pope Francis taking a real stand with some definite specific things that are going to happen and putting some force behind his words and taking action, children are still in danger. Children will still be harmed. Children will still be raped. That's where we have to focus our time and our energy right now.
Well, Mary,
anything short of that is just keeps us stuck in a conversation of those for, those who are against, and in the meantime, more children are harmed.
Yeah.
And the one who holds the buck right now is Pope Francis. He really could do something very significant to make a new chapter, to change the course of history.
Well, Mary, we're speaking here in the middle of in the middle of February, and in the Vatican, they are convening a meeting of cardinals to install some new ones, and they've been tasked on two fronts. One, to reform the Vatican Bank, which is a worthy task. There's a lot of fraud and underhanded dealing that's been going on there, at least from what we know. And the other task is to respond to a survey that Pope Francis initiated, from which he learned that most Catholics don't follow the Church's teaching on contraception. And so he's asking the bishops to operate in this area of family and sexuality where it has absolutely zero credibility. And
right,
your point is well taken.
Himself also, because early on he said, you know, let's just be concerned about the big issues like poverty and whatever. And now that one of their main goals is to deal with contraception and issues like that, why would he not deal with this? Why would this priest abuse and the Vatican demands, I mean, the UN's demands on the rights of the child, the recent demands they've placed on the Vatican, mm-hmm. why would that not be right up there as something to do immediately?
Well, you cannot bend to the will of the blue-helmeted dictators. Now, Mary, before we started recording, you shared a troubling bit of news with me, and that is that there is a Polish archbishop named Wesolowski who is accused personally of child abuse, not just covering up for a priest, but he is personally accused. And mm-hmm. he has been given essentially protection at the Vatican, protection
yeah.
from extradition to Poland?
Yes. And those are the kinds of things that you had mentioned earlier. Well, no, the other cardinal that's...
Law?
That, well, no.
Law or...
Law, cardinal law.
Mm-hmm.
And now this Polish bishop, both being protected, actually, by the Pope, giving them shelter in the Vatican, which is a place where they cannot be touched. That sounds wrong, doesn't it?
It sure does. And it comes back to what we touched on earlier, where the Church claims that local jurisdictions don't have authority over members of its clergy, yet it doesn't discipline them either, and then takes steps to evade the application of justice. We have the bishop from Kansas City who was convicted of failure to report sex crimes, and he is still in office. Am I correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's this line that I'm captivated with. It says, Archbishop Wesolowski is a citizen of the Vatican, and Vatican law does not allow for his extradition.
Hmm. Maybe Julian Assange should move from London to the Vatican if he wants greater protection. Well, this is really sordid, Mary, and I want to try to move to a more positive approach as we wrap up. I learned about your commentary that was published at the CNN website from a friend of mine named Lisa Ray. And Lisa has been active in circles promoting what's called restorative justice. And she has worked with victims and the offenders who committed the crime that made that person a victim to help them reconcile and understand the harm that each came away from a particular incident with. And it has had some remarkable results in state prison settings. It's now being used in high schools to try to come up with alternative ways to deal with behavior problems that don't involve suspension and expulsion and often send those kids onto a crime track. And so restorative justice, to me, offers a great deal of promise, and it parallels in many ways the Catholic sacrament of confession or reconciliation, as it's called. And I believe that the Church could do a great deal of good, even if we only look at its self-interest, if it invoked the teachings of Christ related to forgiveness and reconciliation, and fully disclosed the crimes that have been committed, the cover-ups that were engineered, and acknowledges the deep pain and suffering that have been afflicted on people over these many years. I feel like that is the only way to end this cycle of lying and secrecy and cover-ups by people who claim, you know, to be spiritual and on some path driven by their own spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
So do you see potential for some sort of a large-scale reconciliation effort?
Well, I do. I mean, I see different levels of it. I see the Pope taking a stand, speaking that kind of message. That's just one level. Just hearing the words would restore some faith and belief that he is going to move in the right direction to move deeper into restorative justice. And I think, of course, mending the broken places is essential to healing. And I don't think that comes easily, because you really did a great job touching on all the points that would need to happen. For example, the crimes would need to be exposed, the offenders would need to be exposed, names would need to be released, there'd have to be a new openness in the church and willingness to bear their souls before we can move to that level of forgiveness. And because as a victim, I just having my perpetrator say I'm sorry, without nothing more, I'm not sure how much good that does.
But let me ask.
Help at least to have the person apologize to you that has significantly impacted and harmed your life.
Did George Rucker ever make any form of apology to you?
He did say he was sorry, but the truth about forgiveness, you know, in my own journey, it's about me. What I do with forgiveness. This is a very deep subject for me because I've worked a long time trying to understand forgiveness, and it's not simply the words. There's just so much more that has to go with forgiveness. And we learn that as Catholics, too. If you've offended somebody, you can't just say you're sorry. You've got to make it right. You've got to restore what you can restore. And all those pieces to make it a complete action. It's not even complete until both persons receive it and give it and all of that. But I do agree. It's really a wonderful healing piece in our journey.
And Mary, help me recall the line from the Baltimore Catechism, but as I recall, to complete an act of reconciliation requires a firm purpose of amendment.
Yeah, making amends, desire not to do it again. And in some of these cases, that's what I mean when you asked it. Yes, Father Rucker said he was sorry, but on the other hand, he had lied about all the victims he abused, and I'm not positive, but may have abused another after me. So yeah, it's a little complicated.
Mary,
you have to have a sincere desire not to offend again. Oh, that's what the Catholic Church, to offend again.
Mm-hmm.
You do a penance of some sort. If you can restore what you broke, you do.
Mm-hmm.
If not, there's maybe something else you might do, like give some money to a rape crisis center or something, whatever.
Now, Mary,
complete forgiveness.
I understand. Has the former Cardinal Mahoney ever apologized to you?
Yes, what Cardinal Mahoney did, to his credit, he offered to see any victim, survivor, after he settled all the cases, if they wanted to see him. And I first said to myself, no, why do I want to see him? I'm done. And it was my attorney who said, you know, you might get something out of this. Mm-hmm. So I saw Cardinal Mahoney. And you know, in the moment, it was a good thing. He said he was sorry. I said I forgave him. And in that moment, it was complete. Now, you know, I could go on after that, as my friends have often said, yeah, but did he really mean it? have his actions shown that? And so, you know, I can only say to you that in that moment, I felt he was making his best effort to mend the brokenness he and his priests had caused.
Mary, he's the only bishop or cardinal I'm aware of who has suffered a loss of position or any other public sanction for the sex crimes that occurred under his responsibility. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that is correct. And it was the present bishop who chastised him. Mm-hmm. After of Los Angeles, after he read the horrendous reports that were finally opened in Los Angeles, and told Cardinal Mahoney he could no longer preside at confirmations, which he had continued to do, and some other consequences that I don't know exactly, but yes. However, what offended the SNAP community was the Pope. Pope Francis had a private session with Cardinal Mahoney and then concelebrated Mass with him. And I believe it was on one of the days that the UN was having its meetings.
Wow.
And so to concelebrate a Mass is an honor, and so the message again was not received well by victims, because it showed an insensitivity, I think, to the scope of the problem.
Mary Dispenza, take as long as you like here, but tell my listeners anything that I didn't ask you about or anything that you would like to impart as we wrap up here.
Well, I would like to thank all of those who are working on behalf of keeping children safe. And since my work has been to do that through SNAP and by trying to uncover priest pedophiles and those who have offended children, I want to thank you that share this work with me and keep working hard to put pressure on Pope Francis to mandate that his bishops speak out, expose records, expose priest pedophiles, give their names over to civil authorities and those with allegations to do the same. And remember the bottom line, that all of this is about children. It's about keeping children safe. And if you are among those who love the Catholic Church, all the more reason for you to work hard to make the Catholic Church what it could be, a just, honest, reconciling church that is a light to the world and doesn't hide, but keeps things out where we can see them and keeps us moving in the right direction.
Mary Dispenza, former Roman Catholic nun, thanks for sharing your story, and thanks for fighting for the other victims who still deserve a real form of justice.
Thanks for having me.
Wow, that's a powerful story. I welcome your comments and feedback. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. happy trails to you. Keep smiling.